Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Wonders of the Night Sky, You Must See Before You Die, by Bob King, fairly famous person. I'm just up to this 15th wonder, and some's been informative. I think some of the physics, I think, is for me lacking a little bit, but I've, from reading that, tried to look at some of these from Glenbrook with my binoculars, and really I haven't seen it as much, so I perhaps need a Celestron telescope. And yeah, it takes a little bit to set those up, apparently. Now, this is the Pleiades, and can I say the Seven Sisters, Superu. They see them here. This is a group of seven really bright stars in a cluster. And, Pleiades, I just really love them. Let's see what he has to say. For some things, the naked eye is the best instrument. A meteor shower or conjunction come to mind. For others, the telescope is essential. Think of Saturn's rings and polar caps of Mars. Binoculars fit right in the middle and are perfect when it comes to bright star clusters like the Pleiades, better known as the Seven Sisters. If you're not familiar with the Pleiades, that's the pronunciation there. They're a little cluster of stars shaped like a miniature Big Dipper that climbs into the eastern side of the sky on fall evenings. Yeah, and it's... now, for us, it's, you know you're coming out of winter. You're going through the cold winter and you see it, you know, that's the end of the winter for us. Most people can pick out the six brightest stars and maybe the seventh, but closer look using Avert Vision will coax up dozens to a dozen from a dark, moonless night sky. The cluster looks misty, as if seen through smoke haze, because fainter stars near or below the naked eye visibility blend together to fill in the spaces between the brighter members. Or is that just my frosty breath getting in the way? Oh. Now, of course, I wouldn't be allowed to do this beautiful thing. The Seven Sisters, named for the seven daughters of the Greek gods, Atlas, Pallione, is a true gravitationally bound cluster of stars born together in a cloud of gas and a dust 100 million years ago. So they're pretty new. They move together through space, orbiting from the centre of the galaxy, 444 light years from Earth. So that's almost next door. Counting Pleiades makes an excellent test of both how dark your sky is and the keenness of your vision. I encourage you to take this vision challenge when the cluster stands high in the sky on a moonless night. After you've finished, how about a little dessert? Treat yourself to the most wonderful sights of the sky by pointing a pair of binoculars at the cluster. Only while any pair will reveal wonderful sights in the sky by pointing a pair of binoculars, while any pair will reveal additional stars, the extra light glass of a 40 millimeter or larger glass will show it about 10 times the visible number to the naked eye and enhance their brilliance. Instead of a fuzzy mass, the clusters bright stars burn with blue-white fire. Their palpable sun-like radiance make them look like what they really are, spheres of fiery gas, gleaming heat and light in space with a ferocity we can hardly imagine. The members that outline the Meteor Dipper shine 40 to 1,000 times brighter than the sun. One of the first things you'll notice through binoculars is the attractive arc of some eight stars that uncoils from the southeast with a cluster. Brightest sun, Acalone. It's my favourite part of the cluster, and because it resembles a centipede, that's what I call it. It's called an asterism if he calls it a centipede. All unofficial, of course. Only International Space Astronomical Union can officially sanction and approve star names. But asterisms, like Orion's Belt and Centipede, belong to the common folk. Yes, feel free to dole out pet names to patterns that strike your fancy. Naming helps us characterise what we see, personalise our sky experience. Some names get passed around enough to stick and show up in guides to astronomy books. Examples, along with catalogue numbers, include Eskimo Nebula, Fishmouth, Outside the Run, Atoms of Peace Galaxy. Oh, that's interesting. Well, that's, I love looking at the Pleiades. Now, there's something else I'd like you to look look for using binoculars. Faint nebulosity enshrouds much of the star cluster. Starlight reflects off the tiny dust particles in the nebula in the same way it does off cigarette smoke, lighting up the clouds. Before careful measurements proved otherwise, astronomers thought that the nebula was the remains of the Pleiades birth cloud. But study of the cluster's motion reveal that they are two unrelated. Like a travelling salesman, the Pleiades cluster is just passing through and will eventually leave its furry wraps behind. Wow. It's really interesting because you can see the birth thing leaves a distinctive spectral signature. So we can tell where the stars originated and what they did and all that various type of stuff. The nebulosity appears brightest around the brightest star, but it's faint overall except for a patch that hangs below the star Meope and the lower left corner of the Dipper, resembling breadth on a mirror. It's visible in a 50mm or larger binoculars under dark skies. So the actual light gathering goes up as a square of your binoculars, and it compares the square of your enlarged pupil compared to that of the binoculars in area. So that's, you know, a few millimetres is hundreds of times greater, 100 times greater. Sometimes in cold nights, I look up at the blue luminous sister stars and imagine the heat reaching across the gulf of space to warm my hands and cheeks. Of course, it's all in my head, but the anticipation of the Pleiades returns and warms my heart. I really love the Pleiades. Now, this is Moon Occultion, number 16. I'll talk to you about that. I must admit that I can't see. It's like a moon conjunction. Occult means covering it. Now, there's heaps of things. I do hope they cover it here. If you never watched the moon steal the star from the sky, prepare to be amazed. The moon moves about a fist length each night and travels around the sky. So that's, 30 into 360 degrees is 10 and 12 degrees. So 12 degrees a night to go around. So that's in a day. On an imaginary circle called the ecliptic, the path taken by the sun and the planets, it completes the circle in just under a month and then begins the journey again. So the important thing is that we're spinning, so the things are moving backwards through it. The ecliptic slides through the 12 constellations of the zodiac, familiar to us from astrology, and birthdays such as Aquarius, Scorpius, Pisces, Gemini. Four of the 12 possess a bright star, Scorpius and Teres. Scorpius, Taurus, Aldebaran, Leo, Regulus, and Virgo, Spica. I suppose that makes sense to it. All four stars lie close enough to the moon's path. They're occasionally covered by a satellite and even an event called an occultation. Because they're bright, occultations of the four are sometimes viewable with the naked eye, especially if the moon's crescent and its dark edge covers the star. At other times, binoculars and small telescopes are necessary to see the moon blank the star from view. The moon travels along its orbit at an average speed of 3,638 kilometres per hour. That's four times faster than the cruising speed of a 747. But it's because it's 384,000 kilometres away, that is 1.25 light seconds away, it appears to slowly creep eastward at night to night. As it approaches a bright star, say Spica, the two get closer and closer until Spica appears to hover on the moon's edge, or it feels like forever. Will it disappear? Then all at once, Spiker is gone in a flash. Minutes up to more than an hour. Minutes up to more than an hour later, the moon slides away from the star and it snaps back into view along the opposite edge. The suddenness and brevity of the occultation will take your breath away. You'll learn something important about the moon. It's virtually no atmosphere. Of course, you already knew this, but to see it live before your eyes is to experience the real thing. If it had air like the Earth, the star would gradually fade as it got closer and closer to the moon's edge. That's not what happens. Instead, the star blinks out in an instant. By observing the occultation, we also get a sense of how far away the stars are. Even a star dozens of times bigger than the Sun blinks away in an instant, as if it were a mere pinpoint. It's given a tremendous different distance. Finally, you can directly experience the moon's motion through space as the star makes a fleet retreat behind the lunar limb and pops up on the other side. I think that's the benefit of it. Astronomers used occultations to uncover stars that appear single but have an extremely close but otherwise invisible companion star. The moon's edge acts as a finely honed knife blade that slices the hidden doubles into two. When the star scrapes along the edge of the back lunar disk, flashing in and out, it is a grazing occultation, and you're really in for a treat. Back in the days before orbiting lunar spacecraft, amateur and professional astronomers used this rare event to map and profile the moon's limb with its pointy peaks and crater walls alternating from low and high-lying valleys. Occultations occur at a particular times in a particular region, so an event in Europe might not be visible in the United States, or the moon may occult a star from the southern United States and glide just beneath it for sky watchers in the northern states. Although lots of stars will be occulted in the coming years, there's no occultations of the four bright stars described earlier until the evening of August 24th, 2013. In the first quarter, the moon will cover Antares and Scorpius, and the first series that ends in 2018. Spiker occultations follow in mid-2014, Regulus in 2025, Aldebaran in 2033. Peering into my crystal ball, I've found several of the best visible from North America and Europe, Asia, in the coming decade. Stars aren't the only objects to cross the path of the moon. Planets make great occultation fodder too. They're fascinating in their own right because planets have disks. They're not pinpoints. So it takes the moon seconds to almost a minute to creep over and devour one, depending on how large it appears. It is also wonderful to see the close juxtaposition of the moon and a distant object like Saturn and Jupiter and know that for a time it's been eclipsed from view and gone from the night sky. They use that to see space rocks, except and to map out the edge of space rocks by having astronomers all pointing at one point, and they all collect the occultation information. Yeah, moon dogs. I don't think that's really interesting. Okay, so just sticking time here, that's 13 minutes. Moon dogs. Have you ever seen a ring around the moon, the sun of the moon? Then you're one step closer to seeing your first moon dog. Rings, or halos as they're known, are fairly common once you get to the habit of looking for them. They form in high cirrus and cirrostratus clouds. The thin, feathery ones, when the sunlight or moonlight is bent by billions of tiny pencil-shaped ice crystals. The halo is one piece of a full circle crystal display, which, depending on the type and purity of the crystals and how they reflect light, can be particularly complex with multiple halos, perihelion, better known as sun dogs. In all manners of arcs. When I was 14, I saw multiple halo sun dogs display one March afternoon and moved me to fill an entire page of my sky diary with a pencil sketch of the site, all carefully annotated. Many of the same phenomena happen with the moon, especially around the time of a full moon, when our satellite shines the brightest. Even then, not all crystal creations materialize because the moon is nowhere near as brilliant as the sun. To make all this stuff, nature needs light. The more, the better. That's why we limit this must-see to a moderately rare event, citing moon dogs. That's right, and they're called dogs because they tend to chase the star, and I think specifically sun dogs are 2 points. You know, they're not a ring; they're points either side. Light moves in straight lines at the speed of light, 338 kilometers per second. Unless it's reflected. When a ray of sunlight passes through one of the six-sided pencil-shaped crystals in a cirrus-type cloud, it's deflected not once but twice. First when it enters the crystal's face, and the second time when it exits. The most of the light enters one of the microscopic crystal departs at an angle of 22 degrees. Now multiply the crystal by billions of others just like it, and you get a bright, narrow circle of light around 22 degrees radius, the distance from the sun or moon of the halo's edge. With so many ice crystals up there, why does the halo look like a big bright blur around the sun? Why is it so perfect? It's true that all crystals up there are deflecting light in the same way, but our eyes receive sunlight from these crystals in the right positions to deflect sunlight into our way, and those positions line up to make a circle. That's really crazily mentioned. I don't like that. So far, so good. Because the circle's radius is only half its diameter, the complete lunar solar halo spans twice, 44 degrees, more than four-fifths of the sky. That's big, and a reason that both solar and lunar halos look so impressive. I think they've got a picture of it. Yeah, this is proper moon dogs, because the thing is that they're bright on the left and right-hand side. Not only do bits of ice deflect and refract the white light, they also cause it to fan out components of colours similar to what a prism does. Each colour of light is refracted slightly different degree. The red colours refract less than blue, tinting the halo's inner edge and the outer edge, inner edge red and the outer edge blue. Sometimes you can see hints of yellow and orange between the red and blue, but because these colours overlap, you can be difficult to separate them out. Cirrus and cirrus stratus clouds are also home to plate crystals. Imagine slicing up a pencil like crystal into nice salami into thin flat plates. If the plates are floating randomly, they contribute to the ordinary halo, but if their flat faces are nearly horizontal to the ground, the double refraction of the light through one face and out the other concentrates the sunlight into two bright patches on either side of the halo. So that's where it's plates. That's if they're plates. Yeah, she was. So they must be. The plates actually must be gravitationally aligned. I suppose that's her story. They mustn't be random. They must be. The gravitational field must do it. We call them sun dogs because they accompany the sun like our favourite furry companions would accompany us on a walk. Some even have tails, no kidding. Light exiting the plates at angles other than 22 creates a smoky, blue, pale tail extending outwards. Most sun dogs are subtly coloured for the same reason halos display colours. Each hue is refracted to only a slight degree, the colours often overlapping to make white. Like a halo, you'll see red on the sun dog's inner edge and pale blue on the outer side. Sometimes the sun dog shines almost as brightly as the sun and in vivid colour. You might be driving to or from an errand, be stunned by the sight through your windshield. These rare displays virtually last in just a few minutes and have sometimes been confused with the UFO. Moondogs are technically identical to sun dogs in every way except they're infrequent. That's because you need lots of light to see a moondog, and that only happens during approximately a week-long period centred on the full moon. You don't like to see the colours in the moondog either because the moonlight is no match for the sunlight. Also, the moon is equally extended. Our eyes need more light before the retina's receptors can kick in. Fortunately, cameras are up to the task. Experiment with time exposures of 2 to 20 seconds with your lens wide open. High, thin cirrus stratus are often marked the start of a cold sequence that signals the approach of a warm front around the snow. If you see a halo of moondogs, there's a fair chance it may rain within a day. Before more advanced forms of weather forecasting, this bit of cultural wisdom became a proverbs. When a halo rings the sun or moon, rain approaching on the run. Okay, coming up to distorted moon, but I'll stop this. And so that's She Whiz 15 to 17. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.